This is the story of the trumpet, in the words of those who play it. Young or old, professional or amateur, you've never missed a day of practice, or maybe you're coming back to rediscover the joy you once knew playing your trumpet. For those who love and are fascinated with this crazy instrument that no one can seem to master, or is foolish enough to admit it if they have, this show covers all of the trumpet dynamics.
How did you get started on the trumpet?
Well, with most, like most kids in America, I started with in the fifth grade in the band program. My brothers played horn and trombone. They're 2 and 3 years older than me, so I always copied what they did. So I naturally chose a brass instrument.
So it was just the brothers play brass, so I'm going to play brass. Why didn't you copy them and play the French horn?
Well, I really wanted to play the horn, but my brother would not allow it.
So if your brother didn't get in the way, we could be talking to Mary Bowden, esteemed solo French hornist.
Probably.
How did it work out to, what was it like when you first started on trumpet?
Well, I started on a cornet, which still have, a Yamaha professional model. And so I really think that starting on the cornet helped me have a more rounded tone once I was able to switch to trumpet a few years after that. But it was fun. I loved practicing right away, and the competition of my brothers always teasing me to get better really made me practice a lot, because I was practicing to try to sound as good as they did, because they already had 2 and 3 years on me with their level.
So. How about your brothers? What are they doing now?
They are both in programming. They're classical music supporters. They both don't play anymore, but they're both brilliant people.
That's nice. They're supporters. They're patrons rather than the artists.
Yes.
Do you recommend that, if you're teaching a brand new student, do you recommend that they start on the cornet, or do you think they should start on the trumpet?
I think it depends. I think either is fine, as long as starting with any instrument, if you can start on a good instrument.
You mean like the quality of the instrument?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Whether it's trumpet or cornet, just not having a banged up instrument is ideal. Sometimes I start students off and they have this bargain bin trumpet that's even hard for me to make a good sound on. And so that's kind of starting off on the wrong foot. And I remember when I was first starting, my first teacher was suggesting a student model trumpet, and my dad, who's an electrician, immediately was like, why would we do that? Let's just get her the best instrument that we can. And my first teacher was a horn player, and he had heard that starting on the cornet was a nice way to start because it has a different sound. And so my dad went and got me a professional model cornet, which I still have to this day. So I'm really thankful for that, you know, if you're going to do something, do it the right way right off the bat, so you have a better chance at succeeding.
That's a good attitude. I mean, a lot of kids, they're like, well, their parents will say, well, let's get the cheapy trumpet or the cheapy whatever instrument, and then see if they like it, then you can understand the rationale behind that. But it does something for the morale to have a high quality instrument right off the bat. And you used that cornet in your recent album, didn't you?
Yes, I used it on Norma, and I even used the same exact mouthpiece.
Really?
That I started on. Yes.
What mouthpiece is that?
You know, I'm not even sure. I have to look at what the number is. It's very, it's really deep. I didn't think I could play it again, but then when I was messing around with cornet mouthpieces, my husband, who's a trumpet player, Dave Dash, he was like, why don't you try your first mouthpiece? And I tried it and it felt like coming home. So it's,
wow.
You know, I'm okay with switching mouthpieces a lot because I play a lot of trumpets in my recitals and serif brass shows. So the mouthpiece switching around doesn't bother me too much anymore.
Was it like nostalgic for you to pick up that horn and the same mouthpiece and like play it on an album now that you're an adult?
It was. It was really nice because the trumpet really has a nice dark tone. And the cornet, I should say. And I remember when I first put that mouthpiece in the cornet, my husband's eyes lit up. He was like, oh, this makes so much sense how you play now, because that instrument really is like coming home. You know, it's just easy to do everything on that setup.
That's interesting. How long did you play that cornet before switching to trumpet full time?
I played the cornet for probably about 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I even, so I played a year, and then after a year of playing, I had braces put on both the top and bottom teeth. And so I had braces for the next 3 years after that. And even when I switched to trumpet, I still had the braces. And so that didn't faze me too much because I was a beginner. So I kind of didn't feel like I was losing too much. I remember losing some range and being frustrated, but I got this like really thick wax that you put on the braces, and that seemed to help a lot. And so, that was...
Well, you can adapt to things like that, right?
Yeah, I think so. I know that my brother, he got braces at the same time, and he's 2 years older, and it was really frustrating for him more than me, because he was a very natural player. He could... didn't really have to practice much. It came, a lot of things came really naturally to him. So when he got the braces, he got really, really upset and frustrated.
Is he the horn player?
Yes. And he still is, you know, he'll play, he'll take a, pick up his horn like once a year and play a few notes, and they still sound really good. And then he puts it away. You know, it's, he could have really been like a star horn player, I think.
Well, he decided to make money.
Yes, he did.
Well, I mean, like, I'm just trying to visualize the wax and the braces. That would be much more difficult on French horn with such a small mouthpiece versus maybe a trombone or something. It might be a little easier.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think he ever really tried the wax. I mean, he just kind of went through it and eventually got them taken off. But I think he was just so used to being really great all the time with not practicing.
He just got discouraged, and he just said, screw this. I'm just going to be an electrical engineer or whatever he is.
Yeah.
I mean, enough of your brother. Enough about your brother. He's not featured on this podcast. But I like that story about how you you kind of came home to that cornet. What did your husband say about, he said something like, it all makes sense. Expound on that.
Well, I'm trying to think the exact words that he used. I think he just heard me play and... things that maybe don't come as easy on the, I figured out a lot on the trumpet, but I think the cornet was just like, it just sounded completely 100% like natural and easy when I played it. Mm. Well, he's sitting right here. I can ask him.
Yeah. Why don't bring him on. We can talk. Welcome to the show, David Dash, Mary Bowden's husband. How long have you all been married?
Oh, we've been married since 2013. We've been together for about 11 years total. All right.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Welcome to the show, my friend.
Okay, thanks.
Well, David, I was talking with your wife about, you listened to her play the cornet because she's using this for the, for her album. What was going through your mind? Or she said something along the lines of like, it all made sense to you, like things came together with her sound, and describe that, hearing her play on that cornet.
Well, Mary, on the trumpet, Mary has a really warm and beautiful approach, and she's primarily focused on sound more than any other aspect of playing. And when I heard her play the cornet, that roundness and warmth in the sound was really apparent, and so I could see that that's where it came from.
So, because the cornet is just by nature, it's just a more lyrical instrument. It just encourages lyricism or more beauty, I guess, for lack of a better term, than the trumpet. The trumpet is just like bombastic, and that's why the cornet was like the rock star of the bands way back in the day.
That's right. There's that hilarious letter that Herbert L. Clarke wrote to an aspiring student that said the trumpet is it came from hell or something like that. You know, he thought it would never go anywhere as a solo instrument, and cornet was the only possible instrument that would work.
Well, I think that letter was written to Benj, wasn't it?
Is that right?
I think so.
Cool.
And Benj is like, well, screw you. I'm going to make something of the trumpet. Look how that worked out.
Right. Good. Well, nice to meet you.
Sure, man. Nice to meet you. Well, Mary, let's talk about, we've talked about your beginnings. Like, it sounds to me like the cornet was like the first language of music. And it sounds to me like it translated well into your endeavors as a trumpet player. When did you know that you wanted to play trumpet, be a musician full time, make it your career?
I always knew that I wanted it to be one of my careers. And then I think I was around age 13 where I knew that this is what I wanted to pursue. So it was about 3 years in, probably around the time that I got my braces off.
How did you know?
Well, I think most of my life was being centered around music and trumpets. I loved playing in youth orchestra and practicing all the time and going to concerts. And it was around that time, I was 14 years old, when I decided to leave school in eighth grade. I like to say I'm an eighth grade dropout. And I went to community college. Again, it was copying my brothers. They left high school early to go to community college for an early leavers program. And so I was really jealous that they did that because I did not want to go to high school. I thought it was like too much of a time commitment to be in school that many hours per day. So I was in community college, the same classes, the same gen ed classes that you have to take in high school. It's all the same. But you get college credit, so that it just seemed a more efficient way of doing things. And you get to pick your own schedule. And for me, that was really appealing because I knew that I could get classes done faster in a semester, plus have a lot more free time to practice and work a job, so I could save up and buy a piccolo. So it just seemed, I was already in the mindset of like, well, that what my brothers are doing right now makes a lot more sense for pursuing a life as a musician. You know what I mean? So that's just, it's kind of an unconventional schooling path. But it worked really well, especially since I like had it in my head that I wanted to try to be a musician.
Were there any particular trumpet players that stood out to you as people that you wanted to mimic?
Well, I remember, my first teacher, who's a horn player, Tim Jones in the Chicago area, he would buy us CDs. And the first trumpet CDs that he bought me some Wynton Marsalis CDs, the classical CDs, and also Sergei Nikarikov's first CDs. And so those were the first CDs I listened to, and I fell in love with Sergei Nikarikov's playing. And, I love his lyricism and his approach. I'll never be able to do what he does technically on the trumpet. But just the way, my favorite album of his is his Elegy album of lyrical playing. And so that I just fell in love with that. And of course, when I got older, there's more and more trumpet players that you find out about. And I grew up going to hear the Chicago Symphony during Bud Herseth's last years. And so being in the Chicago area, we were exposed to a lot of great brass playing. And our teacher would take my brothers and I to all of these concerts around Chicago. And he'd buy us tickets and pick us up at the house and take us to the concerts. And so there was a lot of amazing music that we heard growing up.
Well, it's just an environment. It was an environment that encouraged excellence in music. And it just makes sense that you would want to pursue that, being in that environment.
I owe everything to Tim Jones, because having a teacher from that early of an age, believing in my brothers and I, and just taking us to hear live music every week. And he would drive an hour to pick us up and then drive us an hour to the city. And every summer we would go hear Grant Park, and we would go to Ravinia and hear Chicago Symphony. We heard so much music. And I think that was I got to hear all these great concerts, and that's a pretty rare thing. And I look back on that, and I think that we were, extremely lucky to have such a dedicated teacher who would do that for us.
Well, maybe there's a teacher listening to this, and just take that as a word of encouragement. Don't not invest in those young kids, because look what happened with Mary. She had Tim Jones invested in her, and just gave her that motivation to want to be the best that she can be. Now, speaking of Sergei Nikaryakov, I had the opportunity to interview him a couple of weeks ago, and it's on this podcast. And he was talking about his influences on the trumpet, and one of his big influences was Timofey Dokshitzer, right? And big, huge influence on him. Now, my wife was playing some YouTubes, and she just typed in trumpet music or whatever it is on YouTube, and it was like this album on YouTube, and I'm listening to it. I'm trying to guess. I said, "Honey, is that Timofey Dokshitzer?" She said, "No, it's Sergei Nikaryakov." And it's just interesting how, you know, he has that influence from Dokshitzer, and that's how he sounds. So it just made perfect sense that would be Nikaryakov with his influence. What were some of the challenges that you encountered? Let's say you're 14 years old and you've decided, okay, I'm going to do this. What obstacles did you face at that point to become a professional musician?
Well, I think at that time I had, I think it was that year that I also, Tim had me switch to a trumpet teacher. He's a horn player. And so I switched to a trumpet teacher. Her name's Carrie Lee, and she's a freelance musician in the Chicago area. And he thought it was really important that I study with a female trumpeter. And Carrie was amazing. She's an amazing trumpet player and musician, person. And having her in my life really opened up my eyes too. It was really great to have a strong female role model on the trumpets. And so that time she really helped me set a lot of goals. And she also challenged me to play pieces that I thought I could not play. Like I remember when I wanted to audition for conservatories, I wanted to play the Baim concerto, and she was like, "No, let's not play that right now. You're going to learn the Tomasi concerto." And I remember thinking like, I am. And I did. And she always pushed me way past my limits of what I thought I could do. And so I really owe her for that, because she just made me learn all this really difficult repertoire when I was a teenager. And yeah, you know, I think a lot of that is, I know that's risky to do that when you're teaching someone who's a teenager, but it really helped me just get better a lot faster than if I had stuck with just pieces I thought I was ready for only.
You'll have to forgive my ignorance, because I know the Baim concerto somewhat, but I'm not. So is the Tomasi concerto more difficult than the Baim?
In a lot of ways, yes. And it terrified me to play that piece, but then I learned it, and then it became a piece that I can always feel like I can come back home to. And she also had me learn Jolivet concertino. And, you know, it's just these challenges where I was like, I'm learning what? And she just pushed me and I learned it. And she just helped me set goals and really challenged me to outside my comfort zone. So then I ended up getting into Chicago Youth Symphony, which was a great experience for 2 years. And I remember she really pushed me to audition for the Curtis Institute of Music. And I got in, and she believed in me, and I wasn't sure if I could get in, but she really pushed me to really just go for my dreams. Mm-hmm. And I owe her a lot for that.
Why do you think it was important to have a female teacher as a role model? She's not just teaching you trumpet, but she's like teaching you life too.
Well, I think at that point, you know, when I was 10 years old in band, I would always tie for first chair with two other girls. And so I never thought anything strange about being a female trumpeter or brass player, because I always had these peers, these little girls who played trumpet with me, and we'd always tie. It made me really mad and competitive. But, you know, but as far as whenever I would go hear concerts, it was mostly male trumpeters, which I never crossed my mind as being strange or anything, you know? And so I think when I met Carrie and studied with her, and I started to hear her perform, and then I started hearing Barbara Butler perform too, because they came to Northwestern. Her and Charlie Geyer came to Northwestern to teach. So I remember hearing her play the Brandenburg Concerto when I was like 17 years old and being blown away. You know, Carrie told me about these female performers. And besides Carrie and Barbara Butler, my teacher gave me a CD of B.B. Black as well, I didn't really know of any other female trumpeters at that time. who I had come in contact with personally. And so I just thought it was just really inspiring. But, you know, as an adult, one of the reasons why I decided to have my brass quintet, Seraph Brass, be all female was to provide role models for younger students, just to show that women can play brass instruments well. And, you know, hopefully throughout time, you know, we won't be called an all-female brass group. It'll just be normalized where there'll be more and more all-female or mostly female groups mixed, you know, because, you know, you don't see an all-male group and say, oh, that's an all-male brass quintet.
I was just thinking, like, the Canadian brass, most of their time they've been all-male with a couple of exceptions.
Yeah. And they never label themselves that because it's like a normal thing. And I think that until we're not a novel, and you know, Seraph Brass could be seen as a novelty, but that's why I think it's important that, you know, the label doesn't bother me right at this moment, because I think we're still very underrepresented. I think there's more and more female players. There's definitely a lot more soloists now than when I was a teenager to look up to. So until it's normalized, I'm okay with the label, until we're on equal footing with the representation.
As far as like the representation, do you see it becoming more balanced than it was maybe 10, 15 years ago, or?
Definitely. I mean, there's a handful of female brass groups that are forming out in the world, and we're not the only group, you know, so it's really inspiring and really cool to see that. I'm seeing younger groups in college form all female brass groups, who are they've been inspired by what Seraph Brass is doing. So I think that in more and more females are picking up brass instruments, and I love playing for kids when we're on the road with Seraph and seeing the excitement of, you know, 10-year-old girls who had just started the trombone, and they're actually seeing someone do that for a living.
Yeah.
They just get super excited. And so that's why we love to do this, you know, to inspire the youth.
When did you all start Seraph Brass?
I started the group in summer of 2014. So it's been, I can't believe it's been 6 years almost. Our first season was like a formation season. And then the second season, we started working a little bit. We had about 10 concerts our second season. And then in our third season, we had about 70 or more, maybe 80, because we got booked through a tour company.
Mm, okay.
And now we're on average maybe around 60 a year or so. So the group has grown and changed a lot. I'm the only founding member left. Just due to the schedule got really crazy that third year, some people did not want to tour, and that's fine. But I've always been the leader of the group, the one doing almost all of the work for the group and the idea person. But now the ladies that we've had now have been in the group for about 3 years. The two Rachels have been in since 2016. And so now it's becoming a collaboration, and we all share ideas and brainstorm and help with the administrative tasks. And so it's now become a more of an equal footing and more of a collaboration, which is what I prefer. So it's been really exciting to see how the group has grown a lot.
When you have this idea for a brass quintet in 2014, or you probably had it before then, but it finally comes together in 2014. You know, we've already talked about, like, you want to be a little bit of an inspiration for females, but what other goals did you have? What other objectives did you want to meet with this group?
Well, I wanted a group that would tour a lot all over the world. And so that was one of my biggest goals, was to do as much touring as possible, as many concerts and educational concerts as possible. Also to have a really high quality group. That's like the number one most important thing, is the quality of the music making. I wanted to create new arrangements for the group, and I didn't want us to be in one genre, like, oh, we only do light classical or we only do contemporary. I wanted us to do a mix of everything. So We've done some more popular concerts. We've done commissions, and we've done a lot of serious works. And we also have a lot of classical arrangements, and we have features for each one of us to stand in front of the band. So it's a really fun mix of repertoire. And I like that because it keeps things flexible. We're not going to be just stuck in one box. And I think everybody really enjoys the mixture of the repertoire that we do.
Describe a typical concert. Like how many people typically show up?
It really depends on the audience of the concert series. I mean, we've had, I don't know how many, the most that we've had, but like it can be pretty full. I'm really bad with knowing the numbers and audiences. you know, we've done everything from like bigger concert series where there's like tons of people. We've done tours for the Allied Concert Services where we're just driving around the Midwest and playing in the northest part of North Dakota. so we've really seen a lot of the country. And now we've started to go overseas, and that's been a lot of fun too. We were supposed to go to China this summer again, but that's looking very bleak.
Yeah, I would say so.
We'll see what happens in the future. So
you all recorded your most recent album, Reverie, in Europe, was it somewhere? Where was it?
Well, Reverie is an album, my solo album that I recorded with a group in Pittsburgh called the Casilla Ensemble.
Okay, I was thinking of the Seraph Brass. You recorded an album
in Finland.
Finland.
With Asteria. Yeah, that's our first album and only album right now. We have a live CD too. Mm-hmm. Our first album through Summit Records was Asteria, which we released in 2018. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of our original arrangements that were made by trumpeter and composer extraordinaire Jeff Luke. He plays trumpet in the Utah Symphony now, and he's done a lot of our arrangements for the group. And so the CD features those, which you've heard the Liszt Hungarian Rhapsody number two. He actually made that arrangement for Atlantic Brass. And I'm not sure if they're playing that much anymore, but we decided to resurrect it because it's really, really, really fun. But he's made some original arrangements for the group as well. And then we also commissioned a couple of new pieces by female composers. And it's a good mix of our concert repertoire.
When you started Seraph Brass, what was the reaction of, like, in the classical music community? Was it, it's all women. Great. Was it indifferent? Were people excited about it?
I think people were excited. Because, you know, when you start something new, it's a little scary because you start it and then you hope that it goes somewhere, and you also want to start working and making it an income. And I'm glad that people believed in me, that they believed that a project of mine would be successful. Our first concerts that we did were through church concert series that I had connections with in Richmond and also in Naples, Florida, through organists who trusted my playing a lot. And so they trusted me to bring in a brand new group. And that's how you get your first concerts, through personal connections. And a lot of the same concert series also booked me with the Casilla Ensemble with our new arrangements for trumpet and strings. And so I owe those people a lot because they trust me with my projects. I can start something new, and I know I have people that trust that I will put together a great product. And then once you get concerts under your belt, then it's a lot easier to do cold calls and make those connections to get the groups touring. And it's, so I used what I learned from Seraph Brass with my friends with the Casilla Ensemble. The Casilla Ensemble now is not my group. It's a different group. And I'm hiring them to play with me. They're friends of mine. And so next season, we're doing about 30 concerts all around the Midwest in 2021 in the spring, winter and spring. And so that's going to be super exciting to tour with the string group. I love starting projects and seeing where they go and just creating opportunities. Because as an American trumpet soloist, you know, it's tough here. You don't,
yeah.
you have to make a lot of your own opportunities happen. And so I've really learned how to do that here pretty well. And you have to be willing to work really hard for a long time. And that's outside of practicing the trumpet.
Yeah.
It's the administrative part of it, and being pretty relentless and organized and being able to handle a lot of rejections, because, you know, there's just so many artists trying to get concerts. But you know, I like to be persistent and friendly. And I know that, like, when we do perform a concert with one of my groups, if the presenter's happy, they'll have you back. They'll recommend you to other concert series. And it sort of feeds off of that.
For people listening in, we had a time zone difference because I'm in Vietnam and Mary's in North Carolina, and I just had the time zones mixed up. I thought I was going to be recording at 9 a.m. and it turns out 8 p.m. there is 7 a.m. here. And so she sends me a Facebook message saying, "Hey, you ready to go?" I was like, "Wait, what are you talking about? I just woke up. You know, I'm just having my morning tea. Of course I'm not ready to go." And scrambled using my wife's computer, and long story short, but you were like working on recording something. What were you working on recording while you were waiting for me to get ready?
Well, this is exciting. So I'm not going to give away the project too much, but I've a few weeks ago, when we first learned that we were going to be stranded, and, you know, when everything got canceled, the first day that happened, I immediately thought, like, what can I do? And so I have hired my good friend, Christopher Bill, who, I don't know if you know his amazing trombone videos. He's a great video editor and creative mind. Him and Jeff Luke made an arrangement of one of my favorite songs, and for Mass Trumpet Ensemble.
Wow.
And my favorite trumpeter, Sergei Nikarikov, is going to be playing one of the solos. And so it's really cool to see this come together. And basically, I'm just bringing a lot of trumpeters together on one of my favorite songs, just to share some joy during this time when we're all feeling alone and isolated. And so just trying to bring just some happiness, you know.
How has the coronavirus, I mean, I'm sure it's affected your touring, but how are you, I'm sure it's affected your income too. So are you guys going to be okay through this thing? Are you weathering the storm okay?
We feel very lucky. I just started a conservatory position in the fall at Shenandoah Conservatory. Mm-hmm. And Dave is the trumpet professor at UNCSA, the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, here in Winston-Salem. So we are still working full time from home. We're, you know, using Zoom and teaching our students every day and classes. And so we're able to have that income be steady. Now I was depending on a massive amount of tour income the next 2 months, which is poof, gone.
Right.
So that's no fun, but we are grateful that we have what we have. And you know, it's a very scary time for artists. You know, I spent my entire 20s living paycheck to paycheck. And up till this year, I was pretty much just all my money was from what I was doing every week, is from a different organization. It wasn't until this fall that I had a consistent paycheck week to week with being a professor as well. So, we're lucky, I think.
Yeah. I don't know it's interesting how people are going to react to this. I think, it's moments like this where your world gets completely turned upside down. That's when you take risks. That's when you're like that project that you've been have on the back of your mind. That's when people are going to start. And although it's a little tenuous right now, I think a lot of good is going to come out of it in the end, because people are going to start that project that they've been thinking of, start that quintet or whatever, shake them out of the routine. Now, speaking of a quintet, and we're running short on time here, so this is my last question. But you talked about the Seraph Brass, and it's all female, and it started out with, you know, you want to make a statement, you know, females can play just as well as the men can do. And so you sort of have this undertone of the mission of the group. But I enjoyed your saying that, you know, we don't want that label. We just want to be a brass quintet. So would there be a time where you would be open to allowing men into the group?
Maybe, but not anytime soon. I think that we would definitely do, for instance, you know, we have a trombone position that we're needing to fill. So we have an audition season this next season with candidates coming in. And when we first put out the ad to some trombone professors to, you know, scout out players, we were thinking, how do we word this in our ad? And we decided to, we worded it like female or identifies as female for the audition ad. So, you know, right now we would, you know, take females or anyone who identifies as a female.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is James Newcomb, and you've been listening to the Trumpet Jungle podcast. You can find us on the web at thetrumpetjungle.com. We've been speaking with Mary Bowden, and we can find her on the web at marybowden.com. Founding member of the Seraph Brass, outstanding trumpeter, and I encourage you to go to her website, marybowden.com. It's a very, very well done website with a discography and about the bio is very, very impressive, very highly accomplished musician. A lot of YouTubes on there, so definitely encourage you to check it out. But Mary, we should do this again sometime.
Trumpet Dynamics is produced by Beaten Path Media, LLC. Special thanks to Mike Vax for allowing use of Serenade to a Bus Seat for the show's theme music. To stay in the loop with the growing community of trumpeters who enjoy this podcast, just type trumpetdynamics.com in your browser and you're off to the races. My name is James Newcomb, and I'm your host. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.